Good morning, everyone. Once more, this is a pre-recorded episode of the weekend edition of Mideast Migraines on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM, and we are streaming usually live, but not today, streaming with this recorded broadcast from or on freakradio.org. My name is Ren Tawil, and I'm going to position everything just right here, since I'm sitting in my kitchen, sadly do not have the boom mic in front of me. I'm gone this morning. When you hear this show at 11 a.m. Pacific time, I will be in an annual retreat with my colleagues of the Palestine-Israel Action Committee here in Santa Cruz, California. No phone calls today since I am away from the studio. This being a weekend edition, we'll continue with the reading from Fatal Embrace, Christians, Jews, and the Search for Peace in the Holy Land. By Mark Braverman, says right on the cover, a brilliant book, so says Marcus J. Borg. And Harvey Cox says, this is required reading. Don't ask me who either Borg or Cox are, but they're very short reviewlets are on the cover, so it must be true, hey? Okay, and being an out-of-studio production, it's going to be without music, and I'm just going to plow through the reading here. Okay, once again, we are on Chapter 3 of Fatal Embrace. The book was published, by the way, in 2010, so it's some 6 years old. Let's see. Under About the Book, in the introduction, under About the Book, Chapter 1 provided an overview of the discourse in the U.S. over how to resolve the half-century-long conflict in the Holy Land and the issues it raises for the Christian and Jewish communities. Chapter 2, Braverman told the story of growing up Jewish in post-war America and the crisis of identity and spirit that resulted from his encounter with Israel's occupation of Palestine. Now, in the middle of Chapter 3, it focuses on the impact of anti-Semitism on Jewish history and Jewish experience today. So, we are, and in fact, Chapter 3 is entitled Anti-Semitism, Jewish Identity, and the State of Israel. And he prefaces the chapter with this quotation from Hannah Arendt, who makes a remark about Theodor Herzl, the founder of modern Israel and the author of Der Judenstaat, or the Jewish State. Arendt says, anti-Semitism was an overwhelming force, and the Jews would have to either make use of it or be swallowed up by it. In his own words, anti-Semitism was the, quote, propelling force responsible for all Jewish suffering since the destruction of the temple, and it would make the Jews suffer until they learned to use it for their own advantage. Again, the words of Hannah Arendt on Theodor Herzl, the Jewish State. Author of the Jewish State. I should say, perhaps, that Herzl was the predecessory father of 20th century Israel, because many will accurately point out that in terms of action on the ground in Palestine, it was David Ben-Gurion, a European Jew, who was the father of modern Israel. Okay, let's stop being so formal here and try to get back to where we were in Chapter 3. This, oh boy, we really are. We barely began Chapter 3. Just a couple more things, folks. An important announcement that slipped my mind the last couple of programs of Mideast Migraines. I have now caught up with my archives containing the podcasts for the previous chapter-by-chapter readings of this book, and I think a couple of other books that I had not yet uploaded. I finally uploaded all the chapters so far of Fatal Embrace here that I'm still reading from, and it seems to me I also those pamphlets, those lovely pamphlets about entitled A War for Israel. That podcast has been uploaded and is available at my archives, as well as the origins of the Palestine-Israel conflict, and another pamphlet about by Tom Hayes having to do with the censorship of accurate information out of the occupied territories by the Israeli army and other Israelis. That was a scary and remarkable pamphlet. Okay, where are my archives? My archives for the podcast of past shows are located at the following website, radioforall.net. That's radio, the number four, you know, the digital character four, ALL.NET, radioforall.net. And you may communicate with me through this program's email address, MideastMadness@GMX.com. Again, MideastMadness@GMX.com. Okay, now here we go. Fatal Embrace, Christians, Jews, and the Search for Peace in the Holy Land, Mark Braverman. Braverman. Who lives, by the way, in Bethesda, Maryland, or resides in Bethesda, Maryland. Okay, we recently began Chapter 3, beginning the subsection, Jewish History, Survival and Its Shadows. Zionism was the answer to the anti-Semitism of Christian Europe. The failure, despite the Enlightenment, to establish the Jews as an emancipated, fully enfranchised group in Europe in the 18th and 19th centuries, and the rise of political anti-Semitism in the late 19th century, gave birth to political Zionism under the leadership of Theodor Herzl. Zionism expressed the powerful drive of the Jewish people to establish themselves as a nation among other nations, with a land of their own, and the ability to achieve self-determination. This is why in sermons from synagogue pulpits, in lectures on Jewish history, in classroom lessons for small children, and in spirited discussions about the Israel-Palestine question, you will so often hear the preamble, throughout the centuries, followed by a description of the suffering of the Jews at the hands of our oppressors. It's in our liturgy, notably in the Passover Seder. The story of Jewish survival in the face of unending persecution is in many ways our theme song. It's in our DNA. It's the mantra of our peoplehood. It runs deep. This unique Jewish quality is not the product of some cultural aberration or collective character flaw. The Nazis' campaign to eradicate world Jewry has become part of our uniquely Jewish, quote, liturgy of destruction. This from Mark Ellis, 2004, page 103. The way we Jews throughout the ages have made sense of our suffering by turning to the broader context of Jewish history. Arising from this matrix of vulnerability and victimization comes the Zionist cry, never again. Developing this particular brand of character armor has been part of our survival throughout ages of persecution, marginalization, and demonization. We survived, in part by creating rituals, habits, and attitudes of insularity. Attitudes of insularity, pride, and persistence that allowed us never to forget, never to let down our guard, and to always be proud of our stubborn vitality in the face of, quote, those who sought to destroy us. When, in our modern liturgical idiom, we talk of the state of Israel as, quote, the first flowering of our redemption, we are reflecting the reality of our survival, the meaning of the achievement of political self-determination in the context of Jewish history. It is good to have survived. In chapter 1, we touched on the impact of the Nazi Holocaust on Christian theology. The Nazi era produced a similarly profound effect on Jewish thought. Irving Greenberg, an Orthodox rabbi, has been a prime articulator of the modern Orthodox viewpoint of the place of the State of Israel in contemporary Jewish history. His vision of the place of Israel in modern Jewish life is shot through with messianic meaning. Greenberg writes, and then a paragraph here from Greenberg, if God did not stop the murder and torture, then what was the statement made by the infinitely suffering divine presence in Auschwitz? It was a cry for action, a call to humans to stop the Holocaust, a call to the people of Israel to rise to a new, unprecedented level of covenantal responsibility. It was as if God had said, enough, stop it, never again, bring redemption. The world would not heed that call to stop the Holocaust. European Jews were unable to respond. World Jewry did not respond adequately. But the response finally did come with the creation of the State of Israel. The Jews took on enough power and responsibility to act. And this call was answered as much by the so-called secular Jews as by the so-called religious. Even as God was in Treblinka, so God went up with Israel to Jerusalem. So God went up with Israel to Jerusalem. From a 1981 writing from Irving Greenberg, pages 15 and 18. Treblinka, of course, refers to another one of the infamous Nazi death camps where most of the inmates were Jewish. Okay, continuing. This vision is articulated here by a rabbi, but it is held across a wide spectrum of modern Jewry. The Holocaust and the subsequent establishment of the State of Israel have taken their places as the major events in modern Jewish history. As Jews, we must understand the shadow that this history casts on us today. We have striven to be the masters of our fate, but having achieved this, we must also realize that we are responsible for our actions and for the consequences of these actions. Being free, we have free choice. The tragedy of Jewish diaspora history, in our own cultural narrative as well as in reality, is rooted in our history of powerlessness and passivity. Zionism came to correct this, and it has undeniably succeeded, far beyond the expectations of Jews and non-Jews alike. But if we now become slaves to the consequences of empowerment, then we are not free, and we are not truly powerful. The Jewish state, by using the Holocaust as justification for unjust actions, is betraying the meaning we should take from our history of persecution and marginalization. You cannot achieve your own deliverance, even from the most unspeakable evil, by the oppression of another people. Indeed, in this current era of power and self-determination for Jews in Israel, we face risks to our peoplehood that far exceed the physical perils brought by millennia of persecution. American Jews, asking the unasked questions. Jews must become willing to overcome our profound denial about the injustices committed in the name of Zionism. Walter Brueggemann writes about the prophetic call to grieve and to mourn. Only in this way, he explains, can we hope to move on to a new and better reality. In Brueggemann's view, only when we are able to cry, in the prophet Jeremiah's phrase, for our own brokenness and to confront the implications of the suffering we have caused, can we be the beneficiaries of God's bounty. In other words, we must break through the denial about what we have done. The power structure, of course, is committed to the very opposite. The state turns the story of its... as I explained in the beginning, I am sitting in the kitchen of my personal domicile here, and it is mind-bending how distracting the littlest things can be. Just over my head here above the kitchen table is our birdie clock that tweets a different species every hour. You may have heard the... What is that there? That's a... The cry of the house wren. That's W-R-E-N, not R-E-N as in wren to wheel, yours truly. Okay, let's try to find where we were to begin with. You know, I try to make things kind of entertaining for my listeners, breaking away from the hard stuff every once in a while. Okay, still talking about American Jews asking the unasked questions. Backtrack slightly here. In other words, we must break through the denial about what we have done. The power structure, of course, is committed to the very opposite. The state turns the story on its head in order to paper over the truth. And then in italics he writes, we do what we do in the name of national security. These others are the terrorists, the obstacles to peace. One particularly, quote, slippery form of denial, and evidence of this failure to grieve, is how some Jews take issue with some of the actions of the Israeli government while still avoiding a confrontation with the fundamental issues of justice. This can take several forms. The first is the, quote, pragmatic approach. Essentially an appeal to enlightened self-interest. This is the pragmatic approach. Essentially an appeal to enlightened self-interest. The occupation, so this position goes, was a mistake. It's bad for Israel. Denying self-determination for Palestinians and subjecting them to the humiliation of a military administration breeds hatred and desperation, which is then visited upon Israelis in the form of violence. He italicizes here, we need to get out of the territories for our own sake. Some American Jewish organizations, hoping to avoid being marginalized by the mainstream community or being labeled pro-Palestinian, quote-unquote, adopt this position. Israel, they say, should get smart and change its policies if it wants to live in peace and limit the economic drain of unending conflict. The economic drain of unending conflict. In informal conversations with some American Jews who articulate this position, I have heard confessions that their position is really much more extreme with respect to their feelings about Israeli policy but that they feel it important to you to this line for strategic purposes in order to maintain credibility with the Jewish establishment as well as with government legislators. A second kind of denial, for me more disturbing, is to be found in the ranks of Jewish progressives. In his critique of this element of American Judaism, Jewish liberation theologian Mark Ellis notes that whereas Jews in this group recognize the validity of Palestinian aspirations and condemn the human rights abuses committed by Israel, they also accept the idea of Jewish ascendancy as a solution to Jewish history. This viewpoint acknowledges the issue of justice, but attempts to do this within the context of Jewish mainstream assumptions of entitlement with respect to the rights of Jews to the rights of the Jews to historic Palestine, namely, the occupation is wrong, claims the progressive Jewish camp. The occupation is wrong, claims the progressive Jewish camp. It goes against our Jewish values. If we can just clean up that messy business, things will come out all right, and we will be able to enjoy the land with a clean conscience. This viewpoint limits the discourse to actions post-1967. It denies the history of Palestinian displacement prior to that. Consistently, progressive Jewish organizations and individuals avoid discussion of the Nakba, the Arabic word meaning catastrophe, referring to the ethnic cleansing of 750,000 Muslim and Christian Palestinians from historic Palestine by Israeli forces between 1947 and 1949. Finally, it avoids the fundamental question, how can a Jewish state founded as a haven and a homeland only for Jews be a true democracy, providing justice and fair treatment for its non-Jewish citizenry? It also avoids the related and equally fundamental question of demography. How do you maintain a Jewish majority in Israel when the majority of people who have legal claim to that land are not Jewish? When the majority of people who have legal claim are not Jewish. This question, above all others, drives Israeli foreign policy and fuels the current political and military conflict. On the whole, Jews outside Israel, across a wide spectrum from, quote, establishment to, quote, progressive, want to avoid these questions. They are off limits. This is denial. It is a fundamental failure to accept the consequences of Jewish actions in pre- and post-1948 Israel-Palestine, and thus a failure to grieve over the particularly Jewish tragedy of the displacement and persecution of the Palestinian people from which we as Jews suffer today. Returning to the pre-1967 borders will not make everything better. It will not make Israel a just society with respect to the Palestinian citizens living within its borders. It will not erase what was done to the Palestinians who were driven out of their cities, towns, and villages in 1948. It does not place the issue of justice as primary. Rather, it places the interest of the Jews of Israel as primary and promotes an entitled supremacist stance with respect to non-Jewish inhabitants of historic Palestine on whichever side of the final status border they may reside when a political settlement is finally achieved. It preempts our horror over the crimes we are committing and the suffering we have caused. It muffles our own cries of pain over our sins and our cruelties. It suppresses the agony of confronting the contradictions and the excruciating dilemmas. It blocks the discussion. It closes our hearts. Here is Walter Brueggemann describing the necessity for prophetic consciousness if a people is to grow and survive. Quote, "I believe that the proper idiom for the prophet in cutting through the royal numbness and denial is, in italics, the language of grief. The rhetoric that engages the community in mourning for a funeral they do not want to admit. It is indeed their own funeral," close quote. 2001, in the emphasis, in the italics, the language of grief, is in the original quote. "Although it is painful and deeply troubling, I see the ferocity and depth of the current splits within the Jewish community in the diaspora as an opportunity for dialogue. This is an issue of crisis. This is an issue of crisis proportions for Jews, and we need to take it seriously. We must encourage this conversion. We stifle it at our great, great peril. It is our responsibility as Jews to examine our relationship to Israel rather than to passively accept the story fed to us by the Jewish establishment, the synagogues, Jewish federations, lobbying organizations, and the rest of the apparatus devoted to maintaining the mighty stream of financial and policy support for Israel from the U.S. government and from private sources. We must examine our convictions and feelings about the meaning of the state to us personally, especially in relation to anti-Semitism. For example, do I, as a Jew living in America, believe that the state of Israel is important to me as a haven if I should feel unsafe or disadvantaged in my home country?" In this case, referring to his home country of the United States. Continuing, "Do I personally feel that the existence of a Jewish state is an essential part of my Jewishness or of the religious values and beliefs that I hold as a Jew? Do I believe that the world owes a state to the Jews because of the centuries of violence against and persecution of the Jews culminating in the Nazi Holocaust? As Jews living outside of Israel, we need to question where we get our information about the history of the state of Israel and about the current political situation. What news services do we rely on? And what websites do we visit? What do we know about the discussion going on inside Israel today, exemplified by the active dialogue found in the pages of the Israeli daily newspaper Haaretz, in the organizations voicing opposition to Israeli government policy, and in the accelerated pace of revisionist Zionist history being produced by Jewish Israeli historians?" New section. Anti-Zionism is not anti-Semitism. "But this discussion is largely muzzled today in the United States. To be critical of Israel is to be quite simply anti-Jewish. Anti-Semitism," in quotes here, "is another of Rosenfeld's straw men. For Rosenfeld, to question Zionism is to be anti-Semitic. It is not only actual criticism of Israel, but almost any discussion that questions Israel's present course that fails Rosenfeld's loyalty test." And I just threw up in my mouth here a little bit. That doesn't mean anything. Just standard acid reflux. Okay, continuing. "That fails Rosenfeld's loyalty test. This accusation is the favorite of the, quote, my Israel right or wrong camp. And its members wield it like a club against Jews and non-Jews alike. But it is important to distinguish, quote, anti-Zionism But it is important to distinguish anti-Zionism as such from criticism of Israel stemming from horror, shame, and outrage at the illegal actions of the Jewish state. Zionism is an ideology, and as such, it can be subscribed to and debated like any other. In contrast, the state of Israel is a political entity, a nation state that, like any other, should be held to standards of human rights, international law. Whoops. Hang on, folks. Okay, please forgive. I just pressed a button on my keyboard here, which started to freak me out because it did something funny to my recording device. Everything seems to be on the up and up now. Now, where was I? Zionism is an ideology, and as such, it can be subscribed to and debated like any other. In contrast, the state of Israel is a political entity, a nation state, that, like any other, should be held to standards of human rights, international law, fairness, and common decency. One could argue that one can be an ardent Zionist and still feel horror at, or at least feel grave concern about, Israel's policies and actions, and thus be moved to voice these opinions or even to political activism. Does this point up the need for an updated definition of Zionism, or the need to ask whether the term is even relevant any longer as we consider the future of Judaism? Zionism, stated Avraham Berg, Israeli statesman, author, and well-known critic of Israeli society and politics, in a recent address at a Washington, D.C. synagogue, Berg stated, "Zionism is not the Torah. It's a chapter in our history. Let us go on to the next chapter." Close quote. That was in 2008. Contemporary Jewish historians, social theorists, and theologians have begun to weigh in on the implications of statehood for the Jewish religion itself. Israeli professor of social psychology Benjamin Beit Halami holds that for American Jews, Zionism has become a, quote, religion, kept by the class of high priests in Jewish organizations. That whole clause in quotations there. Religion kept by a class of high priests in Jewish organizations from 1993. But, he writes, it is a, quote, passive religion, quote, more of an abstract faith than a plan of action, from the same work. Beit Halami argues that the actual actions of Israel as a state are irrelevant to the role played by Israel in providing ideological content to make up for the decline in religious traditions and for the growing hunger among American Jews for spiritual fulfillment. Mark Ellis has written that, quote, mainstream Jewish life has evolved into a new form of Judaism, one that seeks and maintains empire, not unlike Constantinian Christianity, 2004. Ellis also points out in his 2004 Toward a Jewish Theology of Liberation that prior to World War II, the Reform movement of Judaism in America was deeply split over the question of the Jewish state, but that following the Holocaust, all dissent was effectively silenced. Thus it was that for me, born in 1948, Zionism, meaning unqualified love for and support of the state of Israel, was inextricably intertwined with my religious education and practice. Once an ideology and a movement among some Jews, Zionism is now effectively inseparable from Judaism itself. What is striking is that the term is subject to use or misuse by extremists on both sides, namely by the uncritical, quote, defenders of Israel's expansionism and militarism, ever vigilant against a possible threat to Jewish survival and ever watchful for the signs of an approaching Holocaust, as well as by outright anti-Semites. New section, the loyalty oath. Rosenfeld maintains that the goal of Israel's critics is not Israel's withdrawal from the occupied territories or a change in state policy toward its own Arab citizens, but to bring an end to the Jewish state itself. For some of Rosenfeld's targets, this is true, if by this one means their principled stand against the concept and reality of a state founded and maintained on the basis of an ethnic nationalist ideology. But is this anti-Semitism? By this logic, Rosenfeld would have accused Rabbi Judah Magnus, chancellor of the Hebrew University until his death in 1948, and Martin Buber, the eminent Jewish philosopher, of being anti-Semitic. Let me read that again so we have all the names and directions proper. By this logic, Rosenfeld would have accused Rabbi Judah Magnus, chancellor of the Hebrew University until his death in 1948, and would have accused Martin Buber, the eminent Jewish philosopher, of being anti-Semitic. They both opposed the establishment of Israel as a Jewish state. But Rosenfeld is not interested in a principled discussion about the nature and future of the state of Israel. Rather, he requires a declaration of allegiance, not to the state of Israel, but to an ideology of which the state is the primary manifestation. Footnote to that here. This issue has recently surfaced in Israeli politics. Following the national elections in early 2009, that was a year before this book was published, Avigdor Lieberman, head of the Israel Betanu, or Israel is Our Home Party, introduced a bill to require a loyalty oath to Israel as a, quote, Jewish, Zionist, and democratic state, end quote. Parenthetically, Israel Betanu, the party, Israel Betanu to advance bill on loyalty oath is the article in Haaretz, May 29 of that year. Given the ultranationalist platform of his party, this bill is understood to target Palestinian citizens of Israel and move Israel toward transfer of non-Jews out of the state. In a recent interview, Daniel Levy, co-director of the Middle East Task Force on the New American Foundation, credited the, quote, Lieberman phenomenon with creating a, quote, moment of truth for Israel. This from the article Israel's Loyalty Oath in the Real News Network, February 20, 2009. And then he gives a link here. I am reading from a printed book, by the way. I'm not reading off of the computer screen. I'm using the computer to record this episode, not only for rebroadcast in my tomorrow, since it's Friday afternoon now, but to record it for posterity. Remember, my programs, when successfully recorded, go to my archives at radioforall.net, radioforall.net. And please don't forget, you can contact me at MideastMadness@gmx.com. That's G as in Michael, M as in George, X as in xylophone. MideastMadness@gmx.com. I think I got that right. Okay. State is primary manifestation. Where the heck was I? Okay, yeah, I finished reading the footnote. That's what I did. It should have made it easier for me to get back to. Okay. Rather, he requires a declaration of allegiance not to the state of Israel, but to an ideology of which the state is the primary manifestation. For him, loyalty to the state of Israel is a test of one's loyalty to the Jewish people. If you challenge the state and Zionism on a fundamental level, you are operating out of unalloyed anti-Semitism. Recall that the article begins with a cataloging of the rise of virulent anti-Semitism, especially in the Islamic world. Anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism are conflated. The effect is to stifle, indeed to render totally impermissible, any criticism of Israel on political, philosophical, historical, and ethical grounds. It's a slippery slope, Rosenfeld would agree. Anti-Israel equates anti-Semite, and anti-Semites want to bring an end to the Jewish people. That's the line of thinking there, the Rosenfeld logic. Continuing. Actually, Rosenfeld has set us on a slippery slope, but not the one he fears. What we see here in full flower is the tyranny of the ideologue. It's the kind of thinking that leads to oppression in the name of God or the nation. For example, in his rant against any notion of economic sanctions or conditions that might be imposed on Israel, Rosenfeld lumps those who would hold Israel to human rights standards required by international law with those who call, quote, into question Israel's legitimacy and moral standing, and those who demand an end to Jewish national existence altogether. 2006. Again, the thrust is all too clear. In italics, we are in the right, and if you are not with us, you are against us. Criticizing Israel is providing aid and comfort to the enemy. Even certain words are out of bounds. According to Rosenfeld, using words like brutal, oppressive, or racist to describe Israel's actions equals anti-Semitism and is simply not to be permitted. This reasoning is not only logically flawed, it is dangerous. In Rosenfeld's argument, permission is not granted to hold any views outside of what is commonly termed pro-Israel by the mainstreams. Behavior, in quotes here, to use Rosenfeld's word, such as identifying with the suffering of oppressed Palestinian people by wearing a pin of the Palestinian flag, or seeking to find a path to peace through an understanding of the root causes of the horror of suicide bombing, is, quote, bizarre and, quote, grotesque, according to Rosenfeld. New section, Easy Targets. Reminder, we are reading from Mark Braverman's 2010 work, Fatal Embrace, Christians, Jews, and the Search for Peace in the Holy Land. And another reminder, Mark Braverman is an American Jew whose, let's see, grandfather or great friend, well, one of his grandfathers was, in his generation, a fifth-generation Palestinian Jew who was born in Jerusalem. The grandfather was, anyway. Okay, so we are hearing the words of a Jewish man who has been to Israel more than once and has dedicated his life to full-time attention to the Palestine-Israel conflict, Palestine-Israel problem, debacle. The thing that we keep running up against when we want to talk about peace in the Middle East. Okay. Again, starting new section here. Easy targets. Rosenfeld never directly discloses his right-wing leanings and how they condition his position on Israel. However, he repeatedly exposes his ideological bias, which in his case is expressed as an animus toward an outright vilification of any views or persons associated with the political left. He discounts what he terms anti-Israel, quote, hysteria as, quote, politically motivated, clearly code for left wing. In other words, criticism of Israel is nothing more than adherence to a radical political viewpoint, one that requires opposition to the state of Israel as a kind of left-wing litmus test. And again, I must apologize for another reason, another of various and sundry reasons for my occasional pauses. Often, when I get into reading, doing the narrative directly from the work itself, from the book itself, I sometimes find myself reading without paying attention to the meaning of the words. I guess I'm worried about stumbling on particular words and phrases. So I do find myself stopping to make sure I comprehend what it is that I just read. So keeping that in mind, let me backtrack here slightly. In other words, criticism of Israel is nothing more than adherence to a radical political viewpoint, one that requires opposition to the state of Israel as a kind of left-wing litmus test. In one passage, using author and professor Jacqueline Rose as his poster child for the leftist anti-Zionist camp, he submits that, quote, "There are many like Rose today. Some are probably no more than italics, ideological fellow travelers." That italic emphasis is added by Braverman here. Close quote. More or less. Having thus dismissed any writers who may fall into this class, Rosenfeld argues that anti-Zionism is simply one more way for these people to, quote, establish their leftist credentials. Then, in another characteristic thousand-league leap of logic, Rosenfeld alleges that, and I quote, anti-Zionism shares common features with anti-Jewish ideologies of the past, close quote. What these ideologies are, or what the, quote, common features shared with anti-Zionism are, is never made clear. The fact that these benighted ideologies do not see this connection, and the mortal danger it poses to the Jewish people, is, quote, from Rosenfeld, quote, "more than just a pity, it is a betrayal," cries Rosenfeld. Rose is, you know, referring to this Jacqueline Rose, is only one of the high-profile critics of Israel identified with the political left, singled out by Rosenfeld, but she is one of his favorites. A British academic, Rose is best known for her work on the relationship between psychoanalysis, feminism, and literature. Rose's leftist credentials alone are enough to discount her entirely in Rosenfeld's view, but again, he uses her simply to set up his argument. In her writing about Zionism, Rose has attempted, in her words, to, quote, steer a clear path between an elated identification with the state's own discourse and a string of insults. From Rose, 2005. But Rosenfeld will have nothing to do with nuance. He advances a shallow critique taking aim at concepts like messianism that Rose introduces as part of a careful analysis, but that Rosenfeld incredibly and cynically takes literally, charging that Rose believes that the Zionists to have been inspired directly by Jewish messianic madmen from medieval times. In like fashion, Rosenfeld seizes upon Rose's use of the word catastrophe to describe the current state of affairs in Israel and occupied Palestine. He, however, links it with the Arabic al-Nakba, the Palestinian term for the ethnic cleansing of Palestine between 1947 and 49. He thus charges her with being, and I quote, "aligned with this reading of history, that the creation of Israel led to a historic injustice against the Palestinians." this is the damning charge? That she acknowledges that injustice has been done to the Palestinians? Here Rosenfeld again shows his true colors. Flat-out denial of the injustices perpetrated by Israel. In other words, if you acknowledge this fact, you are his enemy, and an enemy of the Jewish people, as well as a person who has abandoned all rational discourse. Jews do not have the right to criticize Israel, indeed, to even entertain the notion that Israel is not perfect, or perfectly entitled to do what it wishes. Further on in his attack on Rose, Rosenfeld, in another fallacy-ridden argument, challenges her question, how did one of the most persecuted peoples of the world come to embody some of the worst cruelties in the modern nation-state? According to Rose here. To this, Rosenfeld responds, compared to the truly horrendous crimes of Sudan, Cambodia, Serbia, or Chile, Israel's record actually looks relatively good. End quote. By any standards of logical discourse and decency, this is a despicable argument and merits no further comment. New section. Muzzling voices of protest. Is Alvin Rosenfeld my, quote, straw man? Is Alvin Rosenfeld my straw man? Asks Mark Braverman here. Is it fair or accurate to use this obviously polemical article to represent the attitude of the American Jewish establishment toward criticism of Israel? Are there not moderate, more responsible voices? The answer is that Rosenfeld's piece is the tip of the iceberg of Jewish institutional opposition to all voices that challenge the status quo of unquestioned and unconditional American support of the State of Israel. Accusations of disloyalty, anti-Semitism, and left-wing leanings find expression in myriad ways throughout the Jewish religious and secular establishment in the United States today in response to individual Jews who challenge the prescribed allegiance to the policies of the Jewish state. This allegiance against threats to support for Israel is not limited to Jews and Jewish institutions. The Israel lobby, a, quote, loose coalition of individuals and organizations who actively work to steer U.S. foreign policy in a pro-Israel direction, close quote, to use the definition advanced by Mearsheimer and Walt, as well as Rabbi Michael Lerner of Tikkun magazine, the Israel lobby casts a wide net in its mission to muzzle, quote, anti-Israel speech and activism, perceived as hostile to the Jewish state. Mearsheimer and Walt's term loose does not accurately characterize the well-funded, well-organized, and highly strategic matrix of organizations that together monitor the press, the United States Congress, academic institutions, and the major Christian denominations. Well-published cases in recent years include the successful blocking of Professor Norman Finkelstein's tenure at DePaul University, the unsuccessful attempt to block the tenure appointment of Bernard Professor Nadia Abu El-Haj, and the canceling of Archbishop Tutu's appearance at St. Thomas University. Parenthetically, the Archbishop has become an outspoken critic of Israel's apartheid-like policies and of the blockade of Gaza. Mearsheimer and Walt's article on the Israel lobby, ultimately published in a British journal, had been commissioned by the Atlantic Monthly, but was rejected for reasons that have not been revealed by any of the parties. Let me also read to you this footnote here. Rabbi Michael Lerner's definition from a recent piece in Tikkun magazine is worth quoting. When I talk about the Israel lobby, I mean to refer not only to AIPAC or the Conference of Presidents, but to a range of organizations, including the American Jewish Congress, the American Jewish Committee, the World Jewish Congress, B'nai B'rith, the Anti-Defamation League, the ADL, Hadassah, the Wiesenthal Center, the Federation, this is the Federation here, and the United Jewish Appeal, the UJA, the various Jewish Community Relations Councils, most of the local Hillel foundations on college campuses, most of the Hebrew schools and day schools introducing their students to Judaism or Jewish culture, the array of Federation-sponsored newspapers that are distributed in almost every Jewish community in America. Close quote. From 2007, a 2007 issue of Tikkun magazine. Okay, back to the main text. Let's see here. Almost an hour of the program has gone by. I'm a bit under the wire myself here. I do have to chop. Continuing. Meanwhile, our best thinkers and writers keep producing. In spite of himself, Alvin Rosenfeld, in his piece on the new anti-Semitism, has made an important contribution to the cause for justice and renewal. His, quote, enemies list provides those of us hungry for these courageous voices with a superb recommended reading list. One only wishes he had given more attention to the work of Sarah Roy, senior research scholar at the Center for Middle Eastern Studies at Harvard University, whom we must count as one of today's most courageous and intensely Jewish voices of conscience. Rosenfeld dispatches Roy in two short sentences, citing a passage in which she comments on the, quote, heresy within the Jewish community of comparing the actions and policies of Israel with those of the Nazis. And then in parentheses here, Braverman writes, in the next paragraph, he effectively demonstrates her point by characterizing any comparison between today's Jews and their former victimizers as unseemly. Rosenfeld's attack on Roe Rosenfeld's attack on Roy for daring to address the similarities between the actions of Nazi Germany and those of Israel in its occupation of the West Bank and blockade of Gaza is perhaps the ultimate symbol of the frightening blindness of his perspective. Yes. The frightening blindness of his perspective, Roy's powerful evocation for the central meaning of the Holocaust in her personal history is a cornerstone of her human rights work, along with the work of other Jewish writers such as Norman Finkelstein, who have chronicled the distortion and misuse of the tragedy of the Holocaust. Roy calls on us to honestly confront our current predicament in the light of the incalculable significance of this chapter in our history and indeed of two millennia of anti-Semitism. She calls on us to draw from it the very moral clarity required to see our way forward. In a moving 2007 essay, Roy, again that would be Sarah Roy from Harvard, in a moving 2007 essay, Sarah Roy, the daughter of a survivor of the Nazi Holocaust, writes the following. It's a long couple of paragraphs here. My mother and her sister had just been liberated from the concentration camp by the Russian army. After having captured all the Nazi officials and guards who ran the camp, the Russian soldiers told the Jewish survivors that they could do whatever they wanted to their German persecutors. Many survivors, themselves emaciated and barely alive, immediately fell on the Germans, ravaging them. My mother and my aunt, standing just yards from the terrible scene unfolding in front of them, fell into each other's arms weeping. My mother, who was the physically stronger of the two, embraced my aunt, holding her close, and my aunt, who had difficulty standing, grabbed my mother as if she would never let go. She said to my mother, "We cannot do this. Our father and mother would say this is wrong. Even now, even after everything we've endured, we must seek justice, not revenge. There is no other way." My mother, still crying, kissed her sister, and the two of them, still one, turned and walked away. What then is the source of our redemption, our salvation? It lies ultimately in our willingness to acknowledge the other, the victims we have created, Palestinian, Lebanese, and also Jewish, and the injustice we have perpetrated as a grieving people. Perhaps then we can pursue a more just solution in which we seek to be ordinary rather than absolute, where we finally come to understand that our only hope is not to die peacefully in our homes, as one Zionist official put it long ago, but to live peacefully in those homes. That's the extraction from Sarah Roy in 2007. The essay, truly moving, truly effective. Okay, new section, where do we go from here? Roy's powerful story points the way. Turning from our anger, sorrow, disappointment, and outrage at the evil we ourselves have experienced, we open ourselves to our membership in the larger human community. This impulse is deeply rooted in the Jewish psyche. We demonstrated it in the Jewish left's opposition to the Iraq War and in our synagogue-based campaigns to oppose the genocide in Darfur. We expressed it in our passionate involvement in the American Civil Rights Movement from its beginnings in the 1950s. My earliest memories include accompanying my father to countless appearances at Philadelphia synagogues, where he presented talks and workshops about what we then called prejudice, racism against black people. Dad was a member of the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith, which in those days was at the forefront of the struggle for racial equality. For my father, as for the ADL, being Jewish could only mean actively working for human rights as a member of the society in which one lived. "I am a Jew born at the midpoint of the 20th century," writes Mark Braverman here. "I don't need to be lectured about anti-Semitism. Psychically, as a Jew, I have packed a suitcase under my bed and an eye ever watchful for the anti-Semitism present in Western civilization that, under the right conditions, can turn from latent to virulent. But I am unwilling, on the chance that I might someday need a refuge from discrimination or outright physical danger, to support the continued building of a militarized, expansionist state that is doing more today to fuel anti-Semitism than to construct a solution to it." He is unwilling to support the continued building of that militarized expansionist state. Continuing, "But let us grant that anti-Semitism is on the rise on a global basis. Let us even set out that it is deep-seated anti-Jewishness, and not 60 years of dispossession and ethnic cleansing that is the cause of outbreaks of violence against Israelis by Palestinians. Even if this were all true, is the solution to build a hideous wall that steals land, blocks commerce and agriculture, and cuts families and communities in half?" referring, of course, to the actual physical apartheid wall. Its supporters would call it Israel's security fence between Israel proper and most of the West Bank. Continuing here, is the solution to train your sons and daughters to hate and fear an entire people and to order them to invade their cities, villages, and homes, to humiliate and debase them in front of their children, and to terrify those same children and rob them of a future in their own land? Can anyone believe that this is an answer, in italics, an answer to anti-Semitism?